You're listening to KSCO Santa Cruz, Salinas, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Larry Tye. Larry Tye is the author of several books, including an excellent book on one of the greatest baseball players of all time, Satchel Paige, called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, and a great book on one of the greatest fictional characters of all time called Superman, The High-Flying History of America's Most Enduring Hero. And now Larry Tye has written Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry Tye, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Great to be back on with you.
Ronald Reagan, he's a conservative icon, but he wasn't always such a conservative. He was once a Democrat and was the president of the Actors Union. And in your new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, we learn that Robert Kennedy was not always a liberal. He was once an ally of Joseph McCarthy.
He was indeed. He was a young law school graduate and out looking for a job. And the fact that his dad had given a fortune to Joe McCarthy made Joe McCarthy amenable to taking a phone call from Joe Kennedy and doing anything that Joe Kennedy asked. And when Joe Kennedy said, "Hire my son," Joe McCarthy did. But it wasn't just because his dad said to do it that Bobby went to work for Joe McCarthy. The Bobby Kennedy of the mid-1950s was somebody who, A, was a cold warrior, and B, thought that Joe McCarthy was the one guy in Washington who was taking seriously a threat that the Soviets posed, not just in the Soviet Union and in Eastern Europe, but behind every pillar of the State Department. So he went to work for Joe McCarthy. He did it enthusiastically, and he stayed for 7.5 long months, and might have stayed longer if not for a guy named Roy Cohn.
Well, what was the conflict with Roy Cohn?
So two smart young guys from incredibly different backgrounds, one from a Jewish background in New York City and of relatively modest means, another from an Irish Catholic background in Boston of substantial means. They saw one another as competitors for moment one. They despised one another for moment one, and their antipathy lasted until Bobby Kennedy was killed a decade and a half later.
So Robert Kennedy was an enthusiastic communist hunter?
He was an enthusiastic communist hunter, but it also has to be said in fairness to him that while Roy Cohn was taking Joe McCarthy out on a cliff and having him pursue questionable hearings, questionable witch hunts, the one set of hearings that Joe McCarthy held that got bipartisan support, that got accolades from the press, were the hearings that Bobby Kennedy had staged for him, looking at the during a time that we were fighting in Korea, looking at how our allies were shipping goods and even troops for our enemies. And this was a set of hearings that everybody agreed ought to have been held. It embarrassed the Eisenhower administration. It embarrassed our allies, but it raised legitimate issues. And many people think that had Bobby Kennedy instead of Roy Cohn been the one who survived with Joe McCarthy, that Joe McCarthy might have survived a whole lot longer than he did.
Well, do you think on what basis do you think you conclude that Bobby Kennedy wasn't always a liberal?
So the fact that he was a Joe McCarthy cold warrior, the fact that he started out life with none of the liberal passions that he ended up with, and the fact that he was Joe Kennedy's son, and Joe Kennedy's son who was most like Joe, and nobody would have ever mistaken Joe Kennedy of the 1930s, 40s, and 50s for a liberal.
Well, Joe Kennedy was also, I don't know if he was anti-Semitic, but he kind of, you know, sort of took Hitler's side at one point. What was Robert Kennedy's feelings along those lines?
Yes, so I think that you wouldn't be going out on a limb to say that Joe Kennedy was anti-Semitic, that a whole book full of letters of Joe Kennedy's that his granddaughter published, in fact, had fairly strong evidence, the strongest evidence that I've ever seen for Joe Kennedy's anti-Semitism. And on the one hand, Bobby Kennedy was a whole lot like his father in lots of ways. One of the ways he was not like his father was his attitude towards Jewish America and towards Israel. Bobby Kennedy, a young Bobby Kennedy in the early 1950s, was a correspondent for a Boston newspaper, went to Palestine and came back and wrote a whole series of stories on his admiration for the Jewish state. And Bobby Kennedy would later become a senator from New York and had a very strong relationship with Jewish New York. And Bobby Kennedy, at the end of his life, would have his life taken. His assassin was a Palestinian-American, Sirhan Sirhan, who killed Bobby Kennedy, he said in the letters that he left behind, because of Bobby Kennedy's strong support for Israel. So it was ironic that Bobby Kennedy started out life with the stigma of his father's anti-Semitism and ended up life being killed by a pretty blatant anti-Semite.
In your book, you go into some detail on Robert Kennedy's run-ins with Jimmy Hoffa. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So I said that Bobby Kennedy really despised Roy Cohn. He despised Jimmy Hoffa at least that much. Jimmy Hoffa was the powerful head of the Teamsters Union, was a rugged truck driver himself, a stocky guy, came from no money at all, and he and Bobby Kennedy, even more than he and Roy Cohn, stem from different enough backgrounds. And Bobby Kennedy, after he worked for Joe McCarthy, worked for a senator from Arkansas who took over McCarthy's subcommittee, a guy named John McClellan. And under Bobby Kennedy's staff direction, enemy number one for the McClellan subcommittee was the Teamsters and was especially their brazen rising leader, Jimmy Hoffa. And Bobby Kennedy and Jimmy Hoffa went at it tooth and nail from, again, the moment they met. And when Bobby Kennedy hated somebody, they stayed hated, and Jimmy Hoffa definitely stayed hated for Bobby.
Was this a function of Bobby Kennedy being a conservative and therefore against the union of the Teamsters, or was there something else happening?
There were two things happening. One, it was that, on the one hand, the committee, the subcommittee, were supposed to be investigating labor and management, and the focus was labor. And Bobby Kennedy, it was partly that he hadn't had much of a relationship with labor, but it was just as much. This was Bobby Kennedy, who was a bit more nuanced after his days as a Joe McCarthy cold warrior. And it was Bobby Kennedy feeling like a labor union leader like Jimmy Hoffa, that he felt was corrupt, was selling out organized labor rather than representing labor. So it was Bobby, on the one hand, having no great love for unions, but I think he did feel an empathy for the rank and file of the labor union, and the idea that a leader was stealing contracts and doing things that that Bobby was accusing Jimmy Hoffa of was something that made him really angry. And he wrote an entire book about it, attacking Hoffa, the Teamsters, and corrupt labor unions.
Was Jimmy Hoffa a criminal?
So that's a great question, and the answer is probably, but he was also a hero to the Teamsters. He was somebody who had built the Teamsters into the biggest and most powerful labor union in America, and yet in the process seems to, at various points, have sold them out as well. And so if you were to talk to an old-time Teamsters person and pick them randomly from the union, they would almost all defend Jimmy Hoffa, and yet that the history of corruption that the Teamsters had, they were probably over time the most tainted union there was out there, and that history goes back a little bit before Jimmy Hoffa, but really developed its reputation for corruption during the Jimmy Hoffa era, and that's why Jimmy Hoffa went to jail.
What was the nature of the corruption?
The nature was having unions that ended up being a sellout to the Teamsters, having contracts that he signed with management that seemed to be lining the pockets of Hoffa and his cadre, and at the expense of rank and file. And there were just, Bobby documented a whole series of financial activities that really cast a dim light on Hoffa. And On the one hand, Hoffa never really became rich himself, and yet he seems to have sacrificed his members at the feet of management that he was trying to cozy up to. And he ended up going to jail for... It was ironic because they could never make charges stick with him in terms of a lot of the corruption, and the charges that ended up sticking were trying to fix a trial, and the it was when Bobby brought him to trial and Hoffa wanted to ensure that he won, he did things that corrupted the system of justice and ended up going to jail for that.
We're talking with Larry Tai, and his new book is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Before we continue talking about Robert Kennedy, tell me, Larry Tai, you've written about Satchel Paige, and you've written about Pullman Porter, as you've written about Superman. How did you come to write about Bobby Kennedy? And the second part of that question would be, did we need a book about Robert Kennedy other than the ones that were already out there?
Sure. So you're very polite. If I could rephrase the question, why do we need the 101st book on Bobby Kennedy? And the answer is that I think that there have been some really good books written on Bobby Kennedy and on the whole Kennedy clan. I don't think there was a book that looked at him in the way that I was trying to do, which was partly to use his life as a lens into how America changed from the conservative era of the 1950s and Dwight Eisenhower to the tumultuous era of the 1960s, and Bobby's life was partly a reflection of that change and partly helped steer that change. I also think that the idea of a political transformation, that knowing that arguably the most iconic Democratic figure of the last half century started out on the other end of the ideological spectrum, says to me a lot about the idea that politicians truly can change and grow and even be redeemed, and we all want to believe these days in political redemption. It also suggests that somebody can change without being a flip-flopper, and they can change for the right reasons, and they can change ahead of the political winds rather than in reaction to them. And I think that when you look at somebody like our current president, who started out as a Democrat and started out politically, ideologically, quite different than he is today, his whole transformation can make a cynic out of somebody, I think, in terms of a sense that he was changing to fit a certain kind of profile for where he felt the vacuum was on the presidential spectrum as he was running for office. Bobby Kennedy was sort of throwing the dice, and when he started out helping, along with his brother Jack, get us involved, for instance, in the Vietnam War. And before America had realized that we were making a mistake in Vietnam, Bobby Kennedy realized that, and he stood up on the Senate floor and said something that very few politicians or senators ever say, which is, I was wrong, and we've got to do something about this. And he was doing that at great risk. And on issue after issue, he did that kind of changing in a way that I wanted to go take a look at it. I was also intrigued about him because when I was a high school student, Bobby Kennedy was one of my icons. I went to high school with his tenderest and most vulnerable son, who ended up years later dying of a drug overdose. So I was intrigued by the Kennedy family. And having been a reporter at the Boston Globe, you lived and breathed Kennedys in Massachusetts. And I thought he was, even though his one brother was a 50-year iconic senator and the other brother was president of the United States, I grew up thinking and believe now more than ever that Bobby was the most interesting, the most passionate, the most courageous, and might have been the best president of any of the Kennedys.
Well, I know that you covered Teddy Kennedy and you got to know him and talk to him. Did you ever meet Bobby Kennedy?
I didn't, and that made me really sad. I had, as I say, gone to school with his son. I have spent quite a bit of time in the course of writing this book with his widow. I knew his brother well. I got to know, in the course of doing this book, his one surviving sister, the former ambassador to Ireland, Jean Kennedy Smith, and it makes me really sad, given all that I've read and seen and heard about Bobby that I had never met him.
Who else did you get to talk to when you were working on this book?
So I talked to about somewhere between 400 and 450 people, and they ranged from a couple ex-attorneys general, Bobby's two successors. One was named Nick Katzenbach, and the other was Ramsey Clark. I spent time not just with his widow, but with most of his children. I talked to people ranging from lots of young staffers who had worked for Bobby over the years to his political foes. I talked to Jimmy Hoffa's son, who is now the president of the Teamsters, James Hoffa. I talked to friends and enemies, relatives, and historians who had sort of looked at him, and lots of survivors from the Kennedy administration. The good news to me was that lots of people were not just still alive to talk to, but still alive and had their marbles and had nobody telling them the way the Kennedys historically had done not to talk. There was nobody still left to circle the wagons, so the people I got to felt freer, I think, to talk than they had 20 and 30 years before, when there were people telling him, you know, what stays in Hyannisport, what happens in Hyannisport stays in Hyannisport.
Continuing our conversation now with Larry Tye. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and Larry Tye is the author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Let's talk a little bit more about the transformation to liberal. I mean, you were just talking about his opposition to the Teamsters, and then we know that he was a big friend of Cesar Chavez and the Farm Workers Union. How did he change? Did it happen when he was Attorney General?
So I think if we were looking, the change was gradual, and if I were to say there was ever one or two moments, that would be, on the one hand, simplistic, because especially for somebody like Bobby, he really was evolving from the early to mid-50s all the way till his death in 68. On the other hand, if there was a single epiphany moment that I would point to, it was in November of 1963 when his brother was shot and killed in Dallas. And in an instant, he lost his brother, his best friend, and his whole reason for being politically and professionally, and he was at a loss. And the Ethel, 50 years later, his widow, describes it as a serious clinical depression that he went through, starting in November of 63 and lasting until the next October, nearly 11 months. And it was a depression that was reflected in the fact that he would drive in his convertible in Virginia in the middle of the night, in the middle of winter, going nowhere, just out driving. He would go to work and nobody would want to talk to him because he looked so out of it. He lacked the focus that was his trademark. And when he came out of this depression, which was halfway through his campaign for senator from New York, when it looked like he might become the first Kennedy ever to lose, when he was finally pulling himself out of this depression, it was a different Bobby Kennedy. It was Bobby Kennedy who, instead of relaxing by playing a bone-crushing game of touch football in Hyannisport or in Palm Beach, would be in his room reading Greek tragedies that his sister-in-law Jackie had given him, and recognizing in the story of the Greeks the story of a Kennedy family with great hubris who lost it all. He would suddenly start relating in a way that he never had before to underdogs. We're all some blend, I think, of tough and tender, and the dial with Bobby Kennedy, starting in November 1963 until the end of his life, was moving ever more toward the empathetic and tender side.
Well, it's really interesting to hear you say that, because in your book, during the period in which he was Attorney General, he had wild parties, crazy parties. He had a chauffeur take him everywhere he went. He was a different kind of a guy.
He was. He lived a life of a rich kid, a powerful kid. He lived an extraordinary life, and he was the closest thing that America has ever seen, and I think may ever see, to a co-president. He wasn't just his brother's attorney general. He advised him at the end of the Bay of Pigs, throughout the Cuban Missile Crisis, foreign policy, domestic policy, politics. There was nothing that Bobby wasn't there beside Jack. There was nothing that he didn't do in the social world in terms of partying and having a blast and working hard. And he was just, he was living literally at the top of American society and at the top of the world. And that was all gone. And he had to find a new sense of purpose. And half of him thought about giving it all up, going and traveling around the world with his family. He had he was on the way to having 11 children, and he had enough money that Joe had left him that he would never have had to work a day in his life. And instead, he decided to run for Senate. He spent 4 years as a senator from New York and was a substantially more effective senator than his brother Jack had ever been. And I think his brother Ted, who became a great U.S. senator, spent his 50 years in the Senate trying to be Bobby.
Talk a little bit about Robert Kennedy as a writer. He's written a couple of books. To Seek a Newer World was one. He wrote a book about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Was he forthcoming in his writing?
He was partly forthcoming and partly self-serving in his writing. So he wrote a book called 13 Days, which was the first insider's account of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the 13 days in October in 1962, when we came closer than the world had ever been to a nuclear confrontation with the Soviets. And he told that story. And he told that story in a way that was an incredibly gripping story. And he told that story in a way that was only half true. And the true half was, the untrue part was that he said throughout the missile crisis that he was there by his brother's side, cautioning him to go the route of a blockade instead of doing anything more confrontational with the Cubans or with the Soviets. And the truth was, the truth that we saw later when the cabinet room tapes of the missile crisis were made public 30, 40 years later, we saw that for the first 6 or 7 days, Bobby, in fact, was calling for an airstrike on Cuba. He was as hawkish as anybody in that room, and it was only halfway through, as his brother was moving to a blockade notion, that Bobby jumped on that and became a very effective advocate for the blockade. But he was running for president when the book came out, and he wanted to convey that he was this wonderful dove, and he was, but just for half the crisis.
Talk a little bit about his relationship with Jackie Kennedy.
So the two people who mourned Jack's death the hardest were Jackie and Bobby. And Jackie was suddenly alone with two little kids, and any time you saw her in those days of her early mourning, you saw her with Bobby holding her hand or holding the hand of one of the kids. He was extraordinarily sensitive and helpful to her in pulling through. She was helpful to him. They developed this relationship. She was giving him Greek tragedies to read. He was trying to be a surrogate father in those days to his brother's two orphaned children, and they were really close. And what happened beyond that, I don't know, but they were close in a way that was apparent to anybody who was part of their world.
Well, I guess a related question would be this. President Kennedy was revealed later to be quite a womanizer. What about Robert Kennedy? Was that part of who he was?
So what I can say is that of Joe Kennedy's children, Bobby was the most puritanical and the most sanctimonious. Puritanical by the standards of Joe and his sons left a lot of room for interpretation as to what that means. I mean, Jack was a famous philanderer. Ted Kennedy wasn't exactly known for being faithful or sober in many of his years. And whether Bobby was having affairs or not is unclear. I had in the book some hints of that by people who were spending time with him. And yet it was very clear that he was incredibly committed to Ethel at the same time and to his kids. And I don't think you have 11 kids with somebody unless you like being a father and a husband. And I also think that Ethel knew that every night, whatever was going on, Bobby would be coming home to her. And I think that, you know, there were rumors out there involving Marilyn Monroe with both Kennedy brothers, and lots of other things. And most of the people who were part of that or witnesses to it are long gone. But I think that Bobby also saw close up in a way that nobody else did, what his brother was doing with women, what Jack was, and the risk that that posed to his political career and maybe to the country. And so I think he was very careful about anything that he did, if he did things.
We're talking with Larry Tye, and he's the author of a new book about Bobby Kennedy called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. When Robert Kennedy was Attorney General, he fought a battle against organized crime, and this upset the FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover.
It did. So I mentioned two people that Bobby Kennedy hated. There were two others that he hated, and one of them was J. Edgar Hoover, and the last one was Lyndon Johnson. Bobby Kennedy led a stronger attack on organized crime than any attorney general ever had and ever has since. The good news about that is that it had a real impact. The bad news about that is that in Bobby's mind, when Jack Kennedy was killed, Bobby always would say, it ought to have been me. And I think what he meant by that was that he was worried that what he did in stirring up the hornet's nest and going after organized crime, or perhaps what he did in stirring up a hornet's nest and going after Jimmy Hoffa, or maybe what he did in going after Fidel Castro, that one of those three things might have somehow led to his brother Jack's death. And so while he never backed away from his attacks on organized crime, he always, I think, had a sense of guilt that that might have somehow boomeranged and killed the person who meant more to him than anybody else in the world.
Did he ever come to any kind of conclusion about President Kennedy's assassination?
I think what he felt was the only way he ever really know the answer is if he, Bobby, were president and controlled the levers of the investigation. He never trusted the Warren Commission, I think. I think he never trusted LBJ to get in terms of taking over when Jack was killed and getting to the bottom of what had happened to the president. And I think that Bobby really didn't want to talk about it. He actually would always say, his standard answer was, when asked, you know, who killed your brother, he would say, Harvey Lee Oswald. And he said Harvey Lee rather than the Lee Harvey, because the first time he ever heard it on television, the announcer got the name wrong and said Harvey Lee Oswald. And that was Bobby's standard answer. I don't believe he ever believed it. And I think that, as I say, he had no faith that there was ever going to be an answer unless he was in the White House and could give one.
So do you think that was a motivating factor in his seeking the White House?
I think there were 20 motivating factors, starting with the fact that Joe Kennedy had wanted each of his sons in succession to be president. I think Bobby wanted to do things on everything from civil rights to poverty and decided the best way to do it was to be in the White House. I think he despised Lyndon Johnson and felt he was an interloper and felt that he, Bobby, was the only one who could truly resurrect Camelot and finish his brother's agenda. And I think getting to the bottom of Jack's death was one of the many other reasons.
Why did he and President Johnson have such animosity for each other?
So I think in a way it's what we were discussing with Hoover and with Roy Cohn. They came from different worlds. Bobby was Harvard, was East Coast, was elite in a way that LBJ hated. And LBJ was East Texas Community College, was, you know, the foothills of Texas, grew up poor, was, in Bobby's mind, crass. They just, from the moment they first met, when LBJ was a young senator and Bobby was a young Senate staffer, they were like two dogs where the fur goes up in the back of their necks and they know they don't like one another. And they didn't quite growl, but they came pretty close. And then Bobby didn't want LBJ picked as Jack's vice president, although he went along with the choice partly because Jack wanted it and partly because Bobby knew that it was a smart choice politically. And in the White House, LBJ knew that Bobby despised him, and LBJ got even when he got into the White, when he got into the Oval Office and did everything he could to piss off Bobby. So it was just, it started out bad and it got worse. And it's tragic because the two of them shared this sense that nothing mattered more than promoting civil rights, than ending poverty. If the two of them had ever combined forces, we would have had a civil rights bill much quicker, we would have had more creative approaches to ending poverty, and we might have even gotten out of Vietnam faster.
That's a fascinating what if right there.
Absolutely.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking today with Larry Tye. He's the New York Times bestselling author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Larry Tye, what was Bobby Kennedy's relationship with Martin Luther King?
So that was another strange relationship. On the one hand, Bobby was sympathetic to what King was doing on civil rights, and yet he wanted him to slow down. In the early days, he was more worried about Jack Kennedy not being embarrassed with the Soviets, that, you know, promoting the civil rights leaders embarrassing America in the eyes of the world. He was, his whole approach to everything that he got involved with in the early days as Attorney General, whether it was the riots in Birmingham or Montgomery, the Freedom Rides, everything was, let's slow down, let's take it easy. And that was exactly the opposite of what Martin Luther King wanted to do. And yet King recognized in the earliest days, he told his young protégés, there is good in this guy, Bobby Kennedy, and it's up to us to pull the good out of him. And the ultimate time that it became clear to America just how much good there was in Bobby Kennedy, and to black America especially, was on the night of Martin Luther King's assassination, when Bobby Kennedy gave what may have been the most moving five-minute speech that any politician has ever given in the ghetto in Indianapolis. And he told people that he could relate to the anger. He had lost his own brother. He could relate to the anger they were feeling at the loss of Martin Luther King. And he told them to go home and say a prayer for King rather than getting angry out in the streets. And Indianapolis, where he was speaking that night, was one of the only cities in America with a sizable black population that didn't have a race riot, and the reason was Bobby Kennedy. And he proved Martin Luther King right. Sadly, though, it was after Martin Luther King was dead.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand compassion and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus, and he once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
That was Robert Kennedy speaking on the death of Martin Luther King. And we're talking with Larry Tye, author of Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Robert Kennedy was criticized when he finally did become a candidate for president, that he had waited too long, that he was stepping on Eugene McCarthy's toes.
He was criticized, and it seemed fair at the time. He jumped in 4 days after the New Hampshire primary, when McCarthy, when you added up the Democratic votes and the Republican write-in votes that Gene McCarthy got, he had beaten a popular incumbent president, Lyndon Johnson, and it looked like Bobby was the ultimate opportunist. A guy named Murray Kempton, a famous columnist back then, wrote a telegram to Ted Kennedy saying, "Your brother's entry into this race proves that St. Patrick didn't drive all the snakes out of Ireland." Nice put-down. And that seemed convincing. The truth was, as we find out half a century later, that Bobby had told lots of people, including reporters who are still alive today, that "I am planning to run for president." He told them this 9 days before the New Hampshire primary, but he felt that Gene McCarthy had jumped in earlier, deserved a fair shot at Johnson in New Hampshire, and so he thought he'd wait till just after New Hampshire. And it was not opportunistic, because he had planned to do it earlier. It was ham-handed to wait and to let people accuse him of being ruthless.
Now, you seriously think he had a strong chance of becoming president in 1968?
So I'd go one more than that. I think he was going to be the Democratic nominee, and I think if he was the Democratic nominee, when you consider that Hubert Humphrey, the ultimate Democratic nominee, very narrowly lost to Richard Nixon, with all the stigma of riots at the Democratic convention in Chicago and all the resentment to Humphrey, if Bobby Kennedy had been the candidate, and I think the ticket would have been Kennedy and Humphrey, if that had been the ticket, there was also nobody in America who understood Richard Nixon's vulnerabilities better than Bobby Kennedy, who had run Jack Kennedy's campaign 8 years earlier against Richard Nixon. Nixon was afraid it was going to be Bobby. He knew just how tough Bobby could be, and I think that Bobby would have combined the white support, the, in today's terms, the angry whites who had been with Bobby ever since his Joe McCarthy days. He would have combined them with the Hillary Clinton kind of coalition of minorities and liberals, and that he would have not just beat Nixon, but beat him pretty handily.
Well, Larry Tye, take this what-if scenario a little further. What would Robert Kennedy's presidency have looked like?
So in the first 5 minutes after he became president, I think he lacked patience, and he understood how short life could be, especially if your name was Kennedy. I think he would have been out there promoting a really strong civil rights bill. He would have been trying the most ambitious, creative approaches to fight poverty ever, and he would have gotten us out of Vietnam a heck of a lot quicker than Richard Nixon did. And I like to think, to extend it out even further, that a lot of the issues that half a century later continue to simmer, whether it's racial tension and injustice, or whether it's an incredible wage gap in America, that those things would have been taken on earlier, if not solved, then at least begun to be resolved earlier, and that we might not be where we are today in terms of an incredibly divided country.
Let's get a little more detail. Robert Kennedy, like President Nixon, had been an anti-communist. Do you think Robert Kennedy would have gone to China, would have gone to Russia?
I think he would have done all that more easily. He was already starting to make overtures to Fidel Castro. I think he and Khrushchev had a kind of relationship, a grudging admiration for one another. I think détente would have been easier. Everybody said, and the great cliché in my era was that Richard Nixon, only Richard Nixon, could go to China because he had started out as such an anti-communist. As you point out and as we've discussed, Bobby Kennedy would have had that credibility of having the support of a lot of people who were anti-communist, and he would have been able to do what Nixon did, only he would have pushed it further because he believed in those things in a way that Nixon didn't as firmly. And I think that anything good Richard Nixon did, I think Bobby Kennedy could have done more easily and more quickly, and the bad things might not have happened.
Well, I guess the one last one there would be the space program. Of course, President Kennedy began the race to the moon. What was Robert Kennedy's stance on the space program?
So he understood that it was not just important to get to space, it was important to rally America behind a goal like that, and he got that better than anybody. And I think he would have, from the Peace Corps to the space program to all the best of the things that JFK helped launch, Bobby Kennedy would have been there doing it, partly to fulfill JFK's legacy, and partly because he was one of the people who helped his brother chart those things, so it would have been natural for him to finish them.
So you've written about all these things we've talked about, Superman, Satchel Paige, Robert Kennedy. What are you going to do next? I know you're all involved in Robert Kennedy right now and doing your book tour, but what's next for Larry?
I am, but I just actually signed up for the next book, and the next book is an outgrowth of this one. It's a biography of Joe McCarthy, and a biography of Joe McCarthy that uses McCarthy's life in part to try to understand Donald Trump. Roy Cohn, McCarthy's protege, was 40 years later Donald Trump's tutor, and there's a direct connection in a dozen ways between Joe McCarthy and Donald Trump, and I think that trying to understand McCarthy through lots of new documents that are out there very recently is what I'm going to do next. And it's hugely not as much fun as Bobby Kennedy, but I think that it's really interesting to me, and I hope to somebody else.
Well, it's going to be interesting to me. So when you were working on this, here you're working on this Robert Kennedy book all about this great liberal icon, and I can only imagine that as you were working on it, or maybe even as you were finishing it, Donald Trump was elected president. What effect did that have on you personally, or did you have to do some rewriting in your book at all?
Well, it had two effects. One was having me think about Joe McCarthy as a possible next subject, and the other was realizing that Bobby Kennedy's life is not just a matter of nostalgia. I think Bobby Kennedy suggests ways out of the wilderness for progressives and Democrats and a way of answering Donald Trump, because Bobby Kennedy tapped into precisely the kind of white anger that Donald Trump understood, only instead of taking it in a direction of reaction, he took it in a progressive direction and was the kind of populist that I think Donald Trump pretends to be.
If Donald Trump were to read a book, would you like him to have read this one, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon?
Yeah, I wish he had read this. I would love for him to read this. The somebody from a bookstore in New York sent me a picture of Bill Clinton holding up the Bobby Kennedy book. Bobby Kennedy was the mentor for Hillary Clinton and for Barack Obama, and I would love to think that Donald Trump would read this, if for no other reason than because I talk about a lot of the people that he cared about, like Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn. But that would be a fun thing. If you can figure out a way to get it to him, I'd love to hear it.
All right, I'll let you know. Well,
great.
This is Larry Tye that we're talking to. His new book is called Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. It's a great book. Congratulations on it, Larry Tye, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us about Tail Gunner Joe.
I'd love to, and thanks again for having me on.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. You can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, New York Times bestselling author Larry Tye. His new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.